Hello and welcome to another episode of the Cosmic Library, where you can read the greatest stories in all of the multiverse. I am Jeremy.
I'm Joanna.
We are doing the show in conjunction with Second Union. For more of the latest headlines and entertainment, please go to our website at wearesecondunion.com. Unfortunately, Jesse is not feeling well today, so it's me and Joanna. How are you today?
It's been a long week. It's only Tuesday.
We usually record on Tuesdays, and then like the following day, you know, the American governmental system nearly went to Pol Pot. Pun yeah. Within a pun. That was weird to watch. That I don't want to say that ruined my day, but that just like changed my mindset for the next, I don't know how long in my life.
Look, I'm not saying that I blame Barry Allen for everything, but this is like a flashpoint alternate reality. What the heck did we do for this to have happened the way it went down? Like, that was so bizarre. And, you know, I'm tuning into all these different news stations, like listening a little bit here, a little bit there, finding out who has any information as this thing's happening and unfolding. And I'm just staring there like, this is just a glitch in the Matrix. Like, somebody hacked in, we're all just plugged into the Matrix, and somebody hacked in with this wacko program, right?
Yeah. I mean,
It has to be.
It was almost as surreal for me, and personally, I thought this looked more like Gotham in Kingdom Come than it did actually, you know, than it did anything Barry Allen did, but that's personal. No, I mean, that morning, I saw the news reports that there was a big protest, you know, during the counting of the Electoral College votes. And then half an hour later, I see the news that says that they've marched to the Capitol building. And of course, even though I'm not a big government person, the skeptic in me just said, well, you're going to meet guys with guns, but whatever. And then, then, you know, half an hour later comes the news that they've gotten past the barricades. And I'm still just kind of thinking about what happened with all the other protests through the course of the last year. And then as I'm in the car on my way to the comic book shop during my lunch period to pick up my pull list, is when I hear there's an armed standoff inside the Capitol building. And that's the moment where my brain just kind of snapped and went, are you serious?
Yeah. It's like you tilt your head to the side.
Yeah. You know, I mean, considering the way the police have been responding to protesters all throughout, like, March through to, you know, Wednesday, this really seemed like a very low-key response to a very imminent situation.
Yeah, and I was like, okay, so where are the water cannons, the tear gas, the riot gear? None of that's being used here. What the heck?
You know, and in my family, or in my immediate family, as you can imagine, I am, you know, I'm the biggest minority there. But the one who's actually angry is a Scottish woman I married.
Well, she's, you know, Scottish. She was born angry. Oh, They're always angry.
She is fucking livid ever since Wednesday, really. I keep getting... This is probably, like, the most straightforward group of texts I've had between my wife and I. Usually there's a lot of attempts at humor, you know, both good and bad, and it stays pretty even, but it's all very matter-of-fact. We're talking about latest developments, who's been arrested, who hasn't been, who needs to be identified, you know, who should be prosecuted for what. It's almost like watching two people in a panel show discuss a matter, is the way our text messages have gone over the last, like, 4 or 5 days.
I mean, at least it sounds like good conversation.
I mean, it's weird because between the two of us, she likes to keep, I don't want to say things lighter, but it's more like day-to-day life. I'm the one that usually sits there and tries to talk to her about, you know, politics and a lot of heady items, and not saying that she's, you know, low intelligence or anything. She just doesn't speak about it. I'm the one that does. I'm the overthinker in the family. But now she is... It's kind of astonishing to sit there and realize that she is actually on my level. She just chose never to engage before.
Nothing actually made her that angry before.
Well, something. Not just angry. It's just she's shown that she has an aptitude for politics. She has an aptitude for long-term thinking. It's just she's never expressed it, like, ever. You know, I love her to death. I really do. And I've always been a big believer in that, you know, not every personality trait should overlap. Sometimes there's a push and pull. She brings out things in me I didn't have, and vice versa. But over the last few days, it's like our thought processes are unusually aligned.
Cue the Twilight Zone music.
Pretty much, yeah. And it's one of those cases where it's like, huh, I might have married myself. And now I realize what an error that is.
The redheaded version of you.
Scary.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, it's It's been a strange week because it's affected my thought process throughout. It's like Wednesday night, I usually get on the internet and do like book-based role-playing with a few people. Nobody was in the mood, except for like one person, and I kind of questioned where their head was at. And, you know, I don't know. I'd like to discuss it all. I don't like bringing politics into entertainment, even though the two overlap quite a bit.
It's a very
polarizing discussion, so I tend not to do it. But at the same time, it almost feels like it's the only thing worthy of discussion over the next several months. So it's freaky. It's really freaky.
Yeah, as of that day, all I wanted to do was bury myself in blankets, cuddle my cats, and I started binge-watching Downton Abbey. So that was a thing.
Yeah, I admit I had a polar opposite reaction to it that I don't really want to get into details of because it's a very ugly sense of side of my personality. But I was compelled to do things that I'm not comfortable with. And at 270 pounds, things I'm not comfortable with could cause a lot of destruction.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Just, what a crazy week. Crazy month it's been, and it's only, what, the 12th?
Yeah, I know. It's just like I was so excited about the turn of the year, and then to find out that 2021 is basically 2020 on meth is driving me insane.
Part two. It told 2020, hold my beer.
You know, 2021 is 2020's Florida cousin.
Oh, no. And I'm from Florida. I know how that is.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. That's why I brought it up.
I was the Florida cousin. I got out of Dodge.
Oh, my goodness. And the odd thing was, it did occur to me that while I was reading our subject of this week, Image Comics Bitterroot Volume 1, the overlap between current events and this series was palpable.
Eerie.
Wasn't it, though?
Eerily so.
I was reading it, and about halfway through the volume, I'm just going, wow, this hit right between the eyes. I'm kind of uncomfortable. They're going to accuse me of something.
Yeah, I was like, oof. On the nose, we didn't even plan it that way. It had been on our reading list for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrifying how apropos the series is, but we will get into that after the news of the week. And we will start with Marvel comic news. We will talk about the characters and intellectual properties of the House of Mouse and what they have in the upcoming months. And Marvel has announced an interesting new omnibus. Not quite as interesting as the stuff that drove Joanna insane last week. But it is one of those things that, although I'm not a reader of it, I'm almost intrigued by this. They're releasing an omnibus of comic books that are released in the year 1961. In other words, it's going to be an omnibus of comics that were all released 60 years ago. This is scheduled for release in August of 2021. I believe all these were actually released in the month of August 2021.
Why that year in particular? Just because it was 60 years ago, or
it was 60 years ago? It's a very different version of Marvel Comics. I think you'll recognize the titles, but you'll recognize that a lot of people that we or characters that we usually associate with Marvel were not active during this period. So it's almost like a time capsule of Marvel Comics way back when, and it does include one particular issue that I'm sure is like the centerpiece of this anniversary. So included in this is Journey into Mystery 73 and 74, Kathy number 13, Life with Millie number 13, Patsy Walker 97, Amazing Adventures number 6, Kid Cole Outlaw number 101, Linda Carter Student Nurse number 2, Millie the Model 105, Strange Tales number 90, and several other comics. And I'm sure you recognize the name of Patsy Walker in the middle of it all.
Yeah.
A lot of people, even people listening to the show, may not be aware that Patsy Walker did not start out as the superhero Hellcat. She started out as a slice of life and romance comic. And the character, I don't believe she was a Marvel original. I think Marvel absorbed the company that created her. But later on, they just kind of reused the property and created Hellcat out of the character, which is just intriguing in my mind.
I mean, recycling's good, right?
Pretty much. But at the center of all this, and definitely the most important thing in this anthology, is that in August of 1961 was the release of Fantastic Four number 1.
Okay.
So all of these comics are, I don't want to say classics, but they're all period pieces of just a long dormant period of Marvel Comics. And like I said, it's interesting. I can't say I would own it because I know my taste, and a lot of these is not it. But I am sort of interested to flip through it only because this is a window into the 1960s, which is 6 decades ago. And unfortunately, I don't have a price on that.
It sounds interesting. The subjects aren't my favorite, but I might, you know, leaf through it just to see if it did pique my interest.
Well, something that may pique your interest is the, since COVID started, Black Panther has been on hiatus. I think it's a combination of the pandemic and a few story issues. As of February 24th, Black Panther number 23 will be released. They are finally continuing the story of the intergalactic empire of Wakanda. We've discussed this on and off. This was a period T'Challa was missing. It was also noted during the first volume of Shuri comics we read. But it turns out...
Missing and presumed dead, right?
Excuse me?
Missing and presumed dead?
Yes. But the Black Panther is back on Earth, and the other dimensional version of N'Jadaka, otherwise known as Killmonger, has followed him back to the 616, evidently.
Oh, fun.
And this is a version of Killmonger that lost his body a long time ago, and his mind is fused with a Clintar symbiote, similar to the Venom symbiote.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it turns out that T'Challa is going to have to deal with this, but he's not doing it by himself, evidently. According to the trailer, it seems like just about every major African-American hero in Marvel Comics, including Luke Cage, Ironheart, Cloak from Cloak and Dagger, Shuri, Brother Voodoo, and Rage from the Avengers are all going to give him an assist, in addition to other heroes like Miles Morales and Storm.
Okay, I was going to say, Storm's got to be in there at some point. They're at least on good terms these days.
Yeah, well, if not good, at least affable. But I have no truck with the idea of this. As a matter of fact, a character featuring that many characters, in addition to, I think, AO from the younger X-Men, Misty Knight, and Thunderball.
Oh, nice.
Okay, so I have absolutely no truck with a Black Panther being able to assist help. I mean, this is a character who currently is the chairman of the Avengers. He's finally become a marquee character in Marvel instead of an assisting character in the Avengers or Fantastic Four, right? Okay, here's the one point where I have an issue with this.
Okay.
Now that we finally established that Black Panther is one of the central superheroes in Marvel, why are the responding characters just African-American characters?
That's a good point.
And don't miss
it. As a writer, maybe they're trying to assemble that particular group.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure part of it is because of racial identity. You know, these characters would be very well accepted in Wakanda as people, if not heroes. I totally get that. But at the same time, I think that Black Panther has earned the right to have a larger call than simply the minority superheroes in Marvel.
Oh yeah, for sure. He's got way more allies than that.
And much more stalwart ones as well. I mean, you would think if he's dealing with another dimensional threat, he should at least be able to call upon Doctor Strange in addition to everyone else.
Right, for sure.
So, again, I am not dissuading the issue. I am not, like, poo-pooing it, but at the same time I'm staring at that going, that's cool, but it feels like he should have access to more.
For sure.
I know a lot of people are going to take clips from that and just say, he is being so down on Black Panther. But actually, Miles Morales, now that we've mentioned him, he's about to get an interesting event happen to him in April of 2021. And this may be another speculative buy on my part. And if you're new, a speculative buy is when somebody buys a comic book, not because they're interested in it as a collector or as a reader, but because they think it may be worth something down the road.
All right, so what's going to happen in, you said, April?
April, yes, April of this year. It's going to be Miles Morales Spider-Man number 25. And before we get into this, I have to ask you, if I say notable events in Spider-Man's history, and by Spider-Man, I mean Peter Parker, what comes to your mind?
Mary Jane dying.
Okay.
And their wedding.
Okay.
For the past, like, big events.
All right. Both good guesses, but that's not what I'm alluding to here. It turns out in Miles Morales Spider-Man 25, the second Spider-Man is going to undergo, according to Marvel, his own clone saga.
Oh, neat.
The original clone saga happened in 1994 to 1996 to Peter Parker, where a long time, like, I would almost say Silver Age enemy of Spider-Man, known as the Jackal, cloned Peter Parker repeatedly, and even brought back a clone from a story in the 1960s, and both Peter Parker and his clone both thought they were the original, and there was a big question as to who was the original Spider-Man, especially since Parker's own powers were fading in and out.
Yeah, I'm just getting a visual of that meme with all the Spider-Mans looking at each other and pointing at each other.
Yeah. So, apparently Miles Morales is going to have his own version of that occur this April. And
okay, so two takes on this.
Go
a,
ahead. Yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. But B, why don't they do something different with Miles? Why does it have to be a Peter Parker callback?
You know, there's both positives and negatives to this, because I agree with you. Not only did the Clone Saga happen to Peter Parker, it's not necessarily remembered as one of the most fun or even best events in Spider-Man history. At the time it happened, it was largely derided, partially because Peter Parker was replaced as Spider-Man by Ben Reilly. However, at the same time, it almost feels like a kind of rite of passage event for Miles Morales, as well as it's been well established that Miles handles things very differently from Peter.
Right, yeah.
You know, Miles is not quite the pseudo-genius Peter Parker is, so he handles things in a much more down-to-earth way than Peter does.
Yeah, simpler, kind of less... Sometimes Peter made things way too complicated for his own good. Like, he overanalyzed things, and I know I've got no room to speak on that, but I feel like Miles just has, like, this earnest, straightforward, down-to-earth approach to everything.
Yeah,
and that's helpful for him. That's going to help him so much.
Actually, Miles' situation could create more havoc now that I think about it, because unlike Peter, Miles, at a young age, has several friends that he confides in and a couple teams he's been on, including the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
So if multiple versions of Miles runs around, that could gain whoever is in control of them, or even the clones themselves, access to some very sensitive areas.
That's true, unless he like gets the clones on his side, then he's got like his whole... Spider Army.
Yeah, but they wouldn't make things that easy on a superhero.
No way.
So it could
not a spider superhero. They always get the short end of the stick.
Yeah, so this does have some interesting possibilities and potentialities, but we won't know until it comes out. For all we know, this could be the second coming of the original Clone Saga, wherein everyone just prays no one remembers it.
Yeah. Who
but,
knows? I would at least read it to see.
Well, let's see. Spider-Man number 25, or Miles Morales Spider-Man 25, is going to be written by Saladin Ahmed, and the art's going to be by Carmen Carnero. And according to Ahmed, quote, "After months of build-up, the Clone Saga will be the culmination of the ongoing story threads that have been haunting Miles since the very beginning of Saladin Ahmed's run, according to Marvel Comics. Readers will finally see the full extent of the Assessor's meddling as his clone creations run rampant through Brooklyn. Designed by superstar artist and Marvel Stormbreaker Carmen Carnero, prepare to meet three distinct Miles clones, each one destined to turn Miles' superhero career upside down," unquote. So apparently three very distinct clones are going to be doing whatever it is they do.
Interesting.
I don't know. I mean, there's part of me that thinks that's a good speculation. There's another part that just says you may be overthinking this particular one. I'm on the fence, and I'm going to have trouble deciding about this.
You know, it all depends on execution, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, two different people can tell the same story arc completely differently, so we'll see how he does.
Yeah, although it turns out one of my recent speculative buys has turned out to be a winner.
Okay.
I bought the standard cover to the first issue of Star Wars The High Republic last week.
Oh, yeah.
And you know me, I'm not a major Star Wars fan, but I saw that and just thought this will be the first appearance in comics of I don't know who, and I don't know what. So I thought I'd pick it up. The first issue had to do with one particular Padawan and a one-armed lizard-like Jedi Master. It was kind of an intriguing thing to flip through.
Hmm.
It turns out it's already going for $15 on eBay as of last week.
Wow.
And that's just the standard cover. One of the variants by Ario Anandito is going for $20. Stephanie Hans goes from about 30 to 40, and as of last week, a variant cover by Sway was going for 70.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm going to keep an eye on that over the next couple weeks and see how that appreciates, because I may have accidentally tripped across something here.
Nice.
Although I do have an announcement that you are going to find very interesting.
Okay.
The first issue of King in Black, Rise of the Valkyries happened last week. And while the full group of four or five Valkyries, depending on which story we're talking about here, was not assembled, it was just Jane Foster and the new unnamed one, who apparently is the most ancient Valkyrie. Their mission is to try and get the soul of the Sentry back. He died in the first issue of King in Black, and apparently Jane Foster was trying to send him on his way to the next realm when his soul was stolen by something. So that is the crux of the miniseries. Why am I mentioning all this? Because it was just announced today that Jason Aaron and Torin Gronbeck will be writers with art by Mattea DeLuis on a new series called The Mighty Valkyries. The Mighty Valkyries is going to be about the reborn group of Valkyries organized by Jane Foster after the King in Black event. Both she and this mysterious first of the Valkyries will be in this series, as well as other Valkyries that have not been named. According to Marvel's official synopsis, quote, Jane Foster believed she was the only Valkyrie left, but the fight against Null, the King in Black, proved her wrong. Now the Valkyries must redefine their roles in a changing world, and Asgard's not going to make that easy. When Loki comes to Jane with rumors of a beast stalking the souls of Midgard, she leaps into action along with the mysterious new Valkyrie who just made her highly anticipated debut in King of Black, Return of the Valkyries number 1. But does Jane's new ally have other priorities? Years ago, this ancient warrior made a promise to the woman she loved. And now, it's time for her to follow through, unquote. According to co-writer Jason Aaron, quote, I don't know exactly how much I can say about the new character. We've shown the preview images, but outside that, she's someone we haven't seen in Marvel Comics before. But I think there will be things about her other people recognize, unquote.
So it isn't first Valkyrie in the Marvel that we know of.
It's the first time she's ever been seen. She has a lot of character traits that are very similar to, what's her name?
Brynhilda?
No. The version of the Valkyrie that we saw in the MCU, Tessa Thompson. It's a lot.
A lot
of her character traits are a lot like Tessa Thompson's character in the MCU, including drinking, really wanting to forget ever being a Valkyrie, and some kind of weird hidden angsty backstory that we're getting snippets of versus Hela. However, at the same time, the new co-writer Torin Gronbeck, and I'm really glad it sounds like they got a Swedish man to help with this.
Yay.
Says, quote, the story is big, cosmic, and mythical. The wolves are let loose, an old god is back, and life is finding its way into hell. People are dying on Midgard, and even Loki has a part to play, which is rarely a good sign for, well, anyone but Loki, unquote.
Yeah, anyone.
I'm not familiar with Miss Gronbeck, but she sounds like she has a good handle on Marvel characters.
Good to me.
She continued, quote, though our Valkyries begin the journey in two very different galaxies, their paths soon meet. But there are twists and turns in the way, and nothing and no one is quite what they seem. They will have to ask the right questions and make hard choices before they can unravel the mystery they both find themselves in. I could say that it's a story about ancient magic, dying worlds, talking horses, and forgotten forces. And while that would all be true, it's also about finding the path back to life after loss, illness, stagnation, and imprisonment, unquote.
Okay.
They are spinning an interesting preview here of what this series could be about.
Well, color me interested.
I'm interested as well, because it occurs to me as we're talking about it, when it comes to Asgardian stories in Marvel Comics, it always revolves around Thor. If not Thor, somebody who's using the powers of Thor. This is the first real series I can think of that has to do with the impact of other Marvel Asgardians on Asgard. All the other times we see him, it's not like we're reading stories about the Warriors 3 as they hang out in New York, or, you know, how Brunhilde relates to the X-Men. It's always very directly about how these characters have these weird side adventures far off. Except now you have Valkyries returning, forwarding the mission of Asgard, both with and without it, evidently, and having a direct impact on that realm of the universe. Maybe I'm overthinking it, but I can't think of any real parallel Thor stories.
No, I'm not that come to my mind.
So, I'm curious to read it. I will probably pick up at least the first few issues to find out what the story arc is like.
Mm-hmm.
And on Facebook, I'm a fan of a few artists, and I've managed to become, I don't want to say Facebook friends, but Facebook acquaintances with a few of them. And that includes one of my favorite cover artists, Mark Brooks. He does a lot of variant covers for Marvel. As a matter of fact, his textless variants to the House of X saga are some of the most expensive ones out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working on rockabilly images of the X-Men for no reason. He started out with doing Rogue in this interesting polka dot two-piece dress. And it got such a response online that he started to add to it. He ended up adding Storm and Jean Grey and I think Psylocke before Betsy Braddock's mind was separated from Quanon, and even added Kitty Pryde in a almost like a military, a 1940s military outfit, or no, probably closer to 1960s, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then he added Lockheed, and then he made a fake cover out of it, complete with Wolverine in like a greaser jacket.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show you the image, not just because it's good, because there's actually a small story attached to it that I was astonished to find out.
Okey-dokey.
Now, first of all, when you take a look at the image, that is pretty.
I like it.
You know, complete with the, not a Studebaker, but it looks like some kind of Chevrolet or Ford behind them. And Brooks did a good job of adapting the X-Women here to, you know, kind of 50s archetypes of all sorts.
Yeah.
You know, you've got everything from preppy to military to hillbilly to rockabilly here.
Mm-hmm. And, like, the pinups, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing that made it curious was, as I was going through the comments for the image, I was expecting the usual back and forth and people showing opinions without really thinking about, you know, what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the top comment was actually from Chris Claremont, legendary writer of the X-Men.
Yeah.
And he's still an active writer. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. the anniversary issue that Marvel's putting out regarding new stories written by him comes out tomorrow. So, as I was going through it, you know, I looked at Chris Claremont's comment, and I nearly dropped my keyboard.
What did he say?
He looked at it and said, "Hell, I'll pitch slash write a concept slash story based on this."
Just the cover art?
Yes!
Nice.
And then Brooks apparently found it and said, "And I'd gladly draw it."
Nice.
So Claremont responds, "Can you please email me a copy of this image?"
Nice.
Evidently, he's serious.
Wow.
And I would totally read an alternative world tale about the X-Men. I mean, I know they were made in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the original stories were 60s, but I've never really read anything from that era, but if you're telling me Chris Claremont and Mark Brooks are going to work on a new series about a lot of modern X-Men getting their start in a 1960s America, which is an era that, you know, the X-Men as an allegory for the civil rights movement would come right out of?
Yeah.
Dope.
Seriously.
I would absolutely read the heck out of that.
I'm here for that.
That would be amazing. I hope they do it. I hope they manage to find somebody at Marvel that just says, "Okay, I've got time."
Yeah. It's some of the styles kind of strike me a little bit more as 50s, but yeah. I mean, either or still.
Yeah, I mean, this is classic Americana, and you know, mm-hmm. I look at this and I think, like, this is an X-Men version of Grease, and somehow that sounds incredible.
Okay, but if Wolverine starts singing, I'm out.
No, if Beast starts singing, I'm out.
Strikes me as a type that would sing like a baritone opera.
You'd probably be the guy with the glasses following everybody around, dropping papers everywhere in the hallway.
Right.
But last up in Marvel comic news, it's actually an X-Men story about a character I've been curious about since the Dawn of X.
Mm-hmm.
Nightcrawler. Since Dawn of X has happened, he's basically turned to the spiritual center of the Quiet Council, and yet he doesn't have a story of his own, and I've been trying to figure out what they were going to do with him. And I was never really sure editorial had a good answer either, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Except now it turns out they have an answer. As of last week, Marvel announced that they're going to have a brand new series with Nightcrawler at the center called The Way of X. Which I know sounds like a, I don't know, a kung fu thriller starring Nightcrawler.
This is the way.
He's German, so it'd be more like, this is the way. But, no, actually it's going to be more about Nightcrawler trying to find a new spiritual path for Krakoa and all that means.
Really? Because he's a devout Catholic.
He is.
Originally.
He's also been a priest in the comics for a little while.
Yeah.
The series is going to be written by Cy Spurrier with art by Bob Quinn, and Nightcrawler is going to assemble a crew to find the path for mutants' answer to spirituality, which is an interesting question, not because I think Nightcrawler has any doubt in his faith, but like everything else on Krakoa, just about everything is new, and they're trying to find a way forward for their people.
So are they going to, like, mesh some together and call it good?
Well, it looks like the answer is going to be a little more complicated than that. According to the synopsis, quote, "Mutant kind has built a new Eden, but there are serpents in this garden. Some mutants struggle to fit in. Some mutants turn to violence and death. And the children whisper of the Patchwork Man singing in their hearts. Only one mutant senses the looming shadows. Snared by questions of death, law, and love, only Nightcrawler can fight for the soul of Krakoa. Only he and the curious crew he assembles, including fan favorites Dr. Nemesis, Pixie, and Blink, can help mutants defeat their inner darkness and find a new way to live. This is the way of X." Unquote. Which is one of those things that made me... Yeah, it made me blink, because I'm not a religious person, so a religious story revolving around X-Men? I mean, I could picture reading it, but I wasn't sure what I would think about it. But this sounds way more involved than that.
Yeah, it does. Interesting.
I also like the picks for this, you know, cobbled together crew they're talking about. Dr. Nemesis, I've enjoyed him since the Cable and X-Force series as the eccentric biochemist.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pixie and Blink are both characters I think are underutilized in the X-Men's main universe.
Definitely are.
Although it is kind of curious that out of the four known members of the squad, you have the Doctor and three teleporters.
Mm-hmm.
That occurred to me early on when I'm reading those names. It's like all three of them teleport.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Cy Spurrier, quote, "I should probably tell a lie for the sake of neat elevator pitches and say that The Way of X is a story about the creation of a new mutant religion. But it's not. Not really. That's kind of where it starts, for sure. Nightcrawler realizes something is wrong with the hearts and minds of mutant kind and sets out to fix it. But as he quickly discovers, this isn't a job for priests and prayers. The question is, what do they have to become in order to fight it? Preachers? Cops? Executioners? Or something entirely new?" Unquote. Which is a very curious question. I mean, it's one of those things that even, I think, a lot of modern religions doesn't adequately answer, is that when you're fighting on behalf of spirituality, what exactly is the battlefield?
Don't know. I mean, from what all they've seen and their ability to resurrect people, what would its role be on Krakoa? That'd be an interesting anthropological question.
Yeah, and he continued with one other line where he said, quote, "Way of X is a smart, psychedelic tale about faith, science, culture, love, and law. And bamfing. Bamfing just for the joy of it." Unquote. So I'm just intrigued by this idea because, you know, yeah, Nightcrawler is one of the most spiritual members the X-Men has ever had. That's not even in question. But when something is wrong with the hearts and minds, as they put it, of Krakoa, how do you fight that? Do you convince people to pray? Do you pray on their behalf? Do you become an exorcist? Do you have to become something more than that?
Probably a little bit of yes to all.
And there's actually another aspect of this which is more terrifying, which would be in the idea of a religious war of sorts between whatever Nightcrawler's putting together and potentially other like pseudo-religious cult-like figures in Marvel Comics like the Rite or the Purifiers. Which becomes not just a war of bodies, but of ideology. There's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, like, wow. A lot more questions than answers.
Yeah, and I know part of that is me just being an overthinker, but at the same time, these are the types of complicated themes comic books have a chance to deal with if they dig just a little bit deeper than a lot of the surface stuff people do.
Mm-hmm. Overthinkers.
Know? Yeah. And I'm not.
Club, we've got buttons.
Yeah, and I'm not talking just the fans. I mean writers too. Sometimes you got to look at things as a multi-headed item and figure out how it affects everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to our odd discussion of Gotham City. Next up, we have DC Comic News. We talk about the other major company in comics and what characters and storylines they have coming now and in the near future. Future State must be doing better for DC than I thought it might. A number of their first titles that were released last week are headed back for second printings already, including a few things that haven't even gotten to a first printing yet.
Oh.
DC announced this week that Future State Dark Detective number 1, The Next Batman number 1, The Next Batman number 2, Wonder Woman number 1, and Harley Quinn number 1, and Swamp Thing number 1 are all going to designer second printings.
Wow.
Dark Detective number 1 and The Next Batman number 2 are slated to arrive both this week and next, respectively. And all of those copies have sold out at distribution warehouses ahead of release.
Huh.
When I say they're designer covers, I don't mean that they're being done by fancy artists. They are all covers of character design models. So basically the first images that DC settled on when they decided on these new versions of the characters are what's going on these new colored covers.
Yeah.
So I give them congratulations. I am, without being too spoilerish, we were discussing next week taking a few of these Future State issues and reading them for review next week, which is all well and good. And I'm glad they're finding success in it. However, I guess it's just a case of I would like to find out how much of a lasting impact Future State is actually going to have. Projected future issues are always kind of dicey, not necessarily because they make bad tales, but because it doesn't take much writing to completely derail where a character was headed. You know, think about what happened when Tom King left Batman and James Tynion the IV came on. Everything was flip-flopped within a dozen issues.
Seriously.
So it's just a case of, are you guys over-planning it, or are you actually going to take us somewhere?
Who knows at this point?
You know, so I'm really curious. And of the issues I read, and I read a few so far, I would say that I'm glad I picked up the first appearance of Yara Flor in Future State Wonder Woman number 1. Her issue, in my opinion, and I know I'm saying this pre-review, which I don't like to do, she was by far the most interesting.
Really?
By far. Whereas a lot of these characters seem to be coming into troubled futures or just their general struggles, Yara Flor feels more like an adventurer.
Nice.
Like she is both into it and passionate about it, as well as a little bit strangely flippant. And I don't mean flippant in the way of, you know, F off, get away from me. I mean flippant in the way of, I thought you were supposed to help me. You know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that character having a bright future if she manages to keep her relatively sunny disposition.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I'm excited to read it. I haven't yet.
Meanwhile, a longtime creator over at DC Comics, exclusive artist Yannick Paquette, has announced that he's leaving the company for new work at other companies.
Oh, wow.
Paquette did parts of Dark Knight's Death Metal number 7, Generation Shattered number 1. His last work will be March 9th's release of Wonder Woman Earth 1 Volume 3. According to Paquette, quote, Death Metal number 7 is out there. As it turned out, this is a fitting celebratory end to my 10 years tenure at DC. I'll venture on to some unannounced stuff for a while, but no doubt I'll get back to DC at some point, unquote. I mean, at least it sounds like there's no acrimony there. But at the same time, you know, I would consider Paquette a pretty big loss. At least as an exclusive. I've got an image here from Death Metal number 7, one of the images that Paquette himself worked on.
Mm-hmm.
I would say he's a pretty good talent and one I'd want to keep.
I wonder why they chose to let him go and maybe not make it a counteroffer.
You know, there's a part of me that thinks maybe Paquette just decided he had other places to be and wanted to stretch his legs, even though he was comfortable where he was. If you were asking me from a cynical standpoint, we know that DC's been drawing down the number of books by, you know, a few, it seems like, every month until they hone it down to whatever they're comfortable with at Warner Brothers. Maybe they didn't have space for him.
I'm just hoping something didn't go bad between them, you know.
It doesn't.
They've
He said in a statement he'd like to return. He could see himself returning. So it doesn't sound like anything evil happened.
Okay.
But well, that image from the Victory Party at Death Metal, that's some good stuff.
Yeah.
If you're wondering, Paquette has done work on Wonder Woman Earth 1 OGN series, Terra Obscura. He did a run on Wonder Woman, Swamp Thing, Batman Incorporated, Young X-Men, and Ultimate X-Men. So, Paquette also didn't say what non-announced DC, non-DC stuff he was working on. He did say, quote, "I'm sure DC will do fantastically this year. I have full trust in Murray Javins. I wish I could help out, but I made other plans already. Keep faith," unquote. He's been working for 27 years so far.
Hmm.
He works out of Montreal. You know, we did read... Well, actually, yeah, I think Paquette was the guy who did the art on the volume of Wonder Woman Earth 1 we did. He's a fantastic artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately, I don't think the scripts were the best use of his talents, though. That's a personal standpoint. Meanwhile, Scott Snyder is tossing around ideas, and it seems like that one of his next works in DC may undo a recent big death.
Mm.
Snyder told Newsarama regarding the death of Alfred Pennyworth in Batman Comics, quote, "I don't want to spoil it for James. I feel like James is playing around with the repercussions of that beat. All I'd say is that it was important for me personally, at least, to see Alfred on my way out for a moment and have the Bat family complete. If we're going to raise the dead and have everyone in it together, there was no one who would put a small brat in his place the way Alfred would talk to the Robin King. It was a beat I really wanted," unquote.
I have mixed feelings. Yeah, most of them are not good.
I mean, maybe he was talking about the scenes in Death Metal number 6 and 7 where Batman used the Black Lantern ring to bring back Alfred's corpse to help them fight and everything, but at the same time, okay, let me phrase this correctly. The character concept of Alfred is fine. I have nothing wrong with it. However, it has been a fixture in Batman comics almost literally since they began back in the 1930s.
And he's not a young guy. And I was okay with the way he exited the story, because I felt like he didn't need to be the mentor anymore. And in a good hero story, the hero has to lose the mentor in order to stand on their own 2 feet, which Batman, let's face it, never has been a good loner. As much as he broods, he's not really a loner.
No.
He needs people around him.
And that's the thing, is that I wouldn't say that the loss of the mentor is necessarily necessary, except Alfred has been Bruce Wayne's security blanket since his parents died.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to operate for a significant amount of time without Alfred. And by that, I don't mean without his billion so he can't afford to pay him. I mean not even the possibility of asking him for help, because this is a period where, like you said, Bruce Wayne needs to learn to stand on his own. And I'm curious to know what things would look like for Batman if he is the one that has to take care of his own costumes and machinery without Alfred to be the extra pair of hands or the voice of sensibility all the time.
Yeah. And, you know, it's sad losing a character, especially a long-standing character like that.
Not to mention one that has neck snap by one of Bruce Wayne's worst enemies.
Yeah.
But at the same... It's one of the few ways they will propel Batman forward is to make him go without Alfred.
Mm-hmm.
So, finish your thought, please.
I don't know. I don't like them resurrecting characters. They do it a lot. They rewrite things like, oh, no, just kidding. We just are toying with your emotions with this one. We're bringing him back. As old as Alfred is or was,
mm-hmm.
I was okay with him having that final resting in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Batman needs his bat blanket, apparently.
Well, the writers seem to think so, anyway. Or Scott Snyder does, anyway. Speaking of Batman, though, one of his more unusual enemies is getting their own series fairly soon. The Man-Bat is getting a miniseries.
Man-Bat.
It was originally supposed to launch in May of 2020, but COVID... Now, mm-hmm. Man-Bat number 1 is scheduled for launch on February 2nd, and the story sounds like it could actually be a good use of the character. According to DC's description, quote, "Man-Bat is on the run from the law following a horrific night of blood and mayhem on the streets of Gotham City. But the police aren't what Kirk Langstrom's monstrous alter ego should worry about. It's Task Force X, better known as the Suicide Squad. To undo the damage he's caused, Man-Bat must seek a cure for the innocence he has injured, all while staying out of the deadly sights of the world's most dangerous mercenaries. Unquote. That almost sounds intriguing to me. It's one of the few times that a villain has to deal with the direct outcomes of his rampages, accidental or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a good story, especially in a backdrop like Gotham. What do you think? Because I'm almost intrigued in this story.
I'm not as intrigued. The story doesn't intrigue me necessarily. I'm not against it. Just,
mm-hmm.
I'm a little batted out at the moment.
I can understand that. as a matter of fact, in that vein, it turns out that Zatanna, Star of the Gravesand, or Jewel of the Gravesand, isn't the only young adult graphic novel that's been delayed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the others they announced, Whistle, has been delayed 5 months. I can't remember who was doing the series, but it was set in a reimagined Gotham City, and Willow is a 16-year-old named Willow Zimmerman who's trying to make ends meet during her mother's cancer treatment. So to help out, she's taken odd jobs from her uncle, who it turns out is a criminal in Gotham City. This doesn't bring her into direct conflict with the Batman, but it does accidentally expose Willow to a material that allows her to understand the thoughts of her dog Leibowitz and vice versa. So, while that doesn't sound like much of a superpower, if you think about it, a relatively mangy and apparently stray dog can actually wander into places and see things that even a person could not.
It's true.
So, if Leibowitz can talk to her directly, she may be able to find out all kinds of information about Gotham's underworld. What do you do with that when your mother needs money? This, to me, is a compelling story.
More compelling than a bat story.
So, unfortunately, this has been delayed by 5 months, which I'm not really surprised about, given what happened to Zatanna recently.
You know, sauce.
It does seem like DC's young adult graphic novels, which were starting out so well, are getting a pretty big lurch when it comes to scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm worried this may be a side effect of what's been happening between DC and Warner Brothers lately.
Or their distributors and whatever other drama they've been having.
You're right, that can also be a part of that. Meanwhile, there's going to be a new illustrated guide to Gotham City, an art book coming soon, by writer Matthew K. Manning and Studio Multi. It's going on sale March 16th, and it's exploring Gotham City in a full-color tour with its heroes, villains, monuments, gadgets, vehicles, and more. It's called
Does it have a pop-up?
I do not see that. It's called Exploring Gotham City. It's the first in a series of large-scale interactive books profiling DC's more iconic creations.
Hmm.
It's supposed to have over 300 illustrations, including locales like Arkham Asylum, the Batcave, and Wayne Manor. I'm kind of mixed on this one. It's interesting, but I'm not sure how interesting. It'd be weird to have a bunch of, like, DC coffee table books.
I mean, I think it'd be cool for the visuals.
Maybe, or it could be good for those kids who are thinking about getting into certain series. It's like, if you want a shortcut, here you go. if you want to see one of the images, it's almost interesting because it's the way it's laid out. It looks like a modern version of those old-fashioned Disney books about a particular subject.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very matter-of-fact, big, wide illustrations using like 1960s and 70s paint scales.
Oh yeah. They still have the T-Rex in the Batcave. Oh yeah. My goodness.
There's a certain quaintness to it.
You know, but it's fun. It's accessible. I like it.
Mm-hmm. I don't have any information on price, unfortunately. Last up in DC comic news, Jeff Lemire and Doug Mankey are working on a secret series for DC's Black Label, where the alternative stories in the DC universe currently happen.
Mm-hmm.
According to Jeff Lemire, quote, "I fell in love with Doug's work when he did Frankenstein with Grant Morrison, and have been a devoted Mankey fanboy ever since. One of the first pieces of original art I ever bought was a page from Doug's Frankenstein, where I met him at a con in Toronto over a decade ago. I had just started Sweet Tooth then, and I remember showing early pages to Doug. He and I talked about working together since, but our schedules never lined up, unquote. Then he continued, quote, well, they finally did last year, and now Doug is drawing a new DC Black Label book I wrote. People often ask, is there any DC or Marvel characters you still really want to write? And this is that character. My favorite DC character that I never got the chance to do the way I wanted, but now I have. Cannot wait for y'all to see Doug's work on it too, unquote. I love his energy.
Yeah.
You know, sounds fun, but I don't know enough about Jeff Lemire's career to even guess which DC character he's talking about. I don't know, though. Some of the Black Label series have been rather interesting. Batman Catwoman had an interesting start, and, you know, I love the Sean Murphy stuff regarding Batman and the White Knight stuff. So, I don't know. Depending on what character we're talking about, I will probably take a look at it.
Be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. You know, while these are loading, I actually had a thought.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about recent Batman stories about how a Grifter suddenly appeared in DC Comics.
Uh-huh.
I know it's not the first time he appeared, but it's the first time in, like, I think the Rebirth era that Grifter has gone anywhere. And I was thinking about that and the fact that they alluded to Halo Corporation and possibly the other Wildcats being active somewhere around Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to think about other, like, Wildstorm properties, and my favorite Wildstorm series ever was Gen 13. You know, are you familiar with the story?
Only vaguely.
Okay. Hopefully this is interesting. If it's not, I'll cut it out of the recording. I don't care.
Okay.
So, Gen 13 in the original Wildstorm comics was five teenagers who were the sons and daughters, both legitimate and illegitimate, of a SEAL team that was experimented on by the government without their okay. It gave them all different psychometric powers, telepathy, psychometrics, telekinesis, sometimes a combination of them all. Some of them went insane, others managed to survive and go into hiding. So Gen 13, they were Gen 12, you know, like the 12th time somebody ran that experiment to give people superpowers. Gen 13 were the kids that they, like, fed this particular additive that managed to kickstart the same kind of chemicals in their system that were passed down from their parents, but created wildly different powers. There was a young lady named Caitlin Fairchild. She developed super strength and invulnerability. Free fall, she suddenly developed gravity powers. Grunge was a metamorph, the kind of metamorph that could mimic anything he touches. You know, Burnout, a pyrokinetic, and Rainmaker, who had limited weather control, but she was one of the few whose gen factor, as they called it, naturally kicked in. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to figure out where these characters could appear, and then it occurred to me that Gotham City would be the perfect place for Gen 13. You would probably have to change their names, because Gen 13, as far as DC Comics, doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it occurred to me how cool... Now, this would be my concept, and I have no way to write it and pitch it, so this is the best I can do.
Okay.
So, Gotham City is not just a dangerous place, it's a perfect place to disappear. All kinds of odd things happen there, and it seems like the city's constantly shifting because of the various gang wars and, you know, supervillain activity, right? So imagine that as the perfect place for runaways.
Makes a lot of sense.
You know, two half-sisters, one with super strength and one with gravity power, shows up, as well as a failed musician who, you know, with the metamorphic powers, a kid who wants to be a race car driver but can never pull it off because of substance abuse issues, and then a young lady whose only real personal turbulence is being Native American, not because she hates it, but because, you know, the kind of feelings that causes from other people.
Mm-hmm.
They all make their ways to Gotham, and instead of being found by any local supervillains or even getting into necessarily trouble, they are individually stealing to survive. And that draws the attention of Alleytown and Selina Kyle.
Yeah.
So what if Selina takes in all these strays and runaways, finds out that she's dealing with a small group of metahumans, and teaches them to steal, not just to survive, but to thrive?
I would totally be 100% behind that story.
Well, not only that, it occurs to me that this could be, like, good long-term storytelling, because what if she's so successful as it, she manages to actually create a gang out of these young metahumans? And like I said, you know, it they would have to change their name because Gen 13 doesn't make a sense. You'd have to find a new interesting name for this crew. But what if this crew becomes so prolific that they get the attention of Batman, who knows he can't deal with this many metahumans on his own, so suddenly it turns into a fight between Selina Kyle's very able metahumans versus some of the best trained fighters in all of Gotham when it comes to Batman, his Robins, you know, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this picture in my mind of, like, this pseudo gang war between Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle, and I'm thinking, this actually sounds like a great story.
The bats versus the cats.
Yes! You know, and it's not even like Selina's trying to save the city. She's trying to do what she always does, save the strays.
Yeah. That would be a really fascinating storyline. I would hope that would be, like, a long-standing series.
Yeah, and some of the matchups intrigue me, too. Like, a lady that can control gravity versus, like, Damian, the guy who thinks the world literally gravitates towards him. Fairchild, who's both intelligent and strong, versus somebody like Dick Grayson, you know, the orphan who's been given everything, for lack of a better term. And some of the individual matchups versus... For some of the individual matchups combined with the potential team matchups, I was just staring at it going, this could be visual candy.
Yeah, they would just be like a ragtag pack of alley cats, essentially. Selina Kyle, there'd be something cat-related.
Yeah, and it's not like all of them have to be thieves. Maybe some would excel at con jobs or lookout or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that? Because the more I was playing within my head, I'm just like, I think I have something.
No, that's really fantastic. And, of course, you know, someone to cover the getaway, having gravity powers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, you could even start the story with, like, Batman on the trail of what he assumes is Firefly, because there's fires being started in particular places, but he can't seem to find an ignition device.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would definitely, it would be completely in character for Selina Kyle to do, and I wouldn't put it past her.
And then it would also add to the storylines of the central characters, because it would be Selina's version of self-serving justice versus Bruce Wayne's, you know, ideological firewall.
Mm-hmm.
Who can actually train...
The good way to collect orphans and train them.
Yeah, wouldn't that be weird to find out who... You know, and a battle of ideologies over the best way to handle lost kids in Gotham.
My money's on the cat.
I feel like I should... I really feel like I should submit this to somebody, because it has the potential to be like a 3-year story.
I'd buy it. I would buy every single issue. I seriously would. And it would be a series that I'd be really excited about, because Selina Kyle needs a good... story arc that would not only define her personality and outline it. Like, there's been a few here and there, but I feel like she's always just been a Bruce Wayne accessory.
Yeah, I can't argue that. I mean, even the stories we've read, if Bruce Wayne wasn't in it, she was lamenting the fact that Bruce Wayne wasn't in it. It was a little tiresome.
It was a lot tiresome. And DC tends to do this with women, though. Their lead women.
Mm-hmm.
Even Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Their accessories, their frames to make the men look good.
Mm-hmm.
This would be something completely Selina's, completely hers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he would probably pop up here and there, but I would like a story to shift away from the main character. Like in Star Wars, I would love some great stories to be told about people who were not Skywalkers.
Well, not only that, I mean, Gen 13, or, again, you would have to rename them, but them trying to pull, like, significant thievery jobs, not just on the organized gangs in Gotham, but potentially some of the other villains in Gotham, would be interesting stories.
Mm-hmm.
As well as probably the battle of wills between Selina and and the other supervillains in Gotham. You know, is Selina the best path for survival, or do they get lured away by somebody more charismatic? Or somebody that just fits with their own ideologies a bit better?
Mm-hmm.
So, there's all kinds of possibilities in that. So, before we bore you any further, the last group of news this week is general comic and convention news. This is where we talk about comic books that are not Marvel or DC related, as well as conventions happening all over the internet. No real convention news this week, but there is a story about Matt Kent and Tyler Jenkins, solving what they call history's greatest murder mystery in a new series called Fear Case. The creators of The Grass King are basically mixing True Detective with The Ring in this series. Fear Case is coming out by Dark Horse Comics. It's about a pair of rookie Secret Service agents who, in a bit of hazing, have been asked to investigate a box. They call it the Fear Case. It's been connected to a lot of crimes and murders, from the assassination of Martin Luther King to Nazi death camps, and even back to the times of the Aztec. According to Dark Horse's synopsis, quote, whoever comes into possession of this case must pass it on within 3 days or face deadly consequences. The agents must track down this Fear Case while staying one step ahead of a psychotic cult and the otherworldly forces behind the case's existence, unquote. Sounds a bit like a murder mystery combined with a meme combined with a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm. That about sums it up.
Well, the first issue comes out February 3rd. I don't know what to think about this. It's a little bit outside my norm, but the synopsis at the very least sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for a couple of rookies. It's not like there's any hard-boiled detective. They got to figure this out fast.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, unfortunately, an iconic artist has passed away this past week.
Oh, no, who?
Steve Lytle passed away. Last name spelled L-I-G-H-T-L-E. He was 61 years old. Unfortunately, he had a cardiac arrest stemming from a COVID-19 diagnosis.
Oh, no.
So even though the COVID was not the direct thing that killed him, I mean, it was still a major part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Lytle, dude, he actually sounds like he's the a superhero in origin. He came from Kansas. He made his comics debut in 1984 with Black Diamond number 4 by AC Comics. Then not long after that, he managed to segue into DC, beginning with a 10-page story in New Talent Showcase number 4. And then he became the series artist on Legion of Superheroes. Lytle has actually been there for a couple of notable Legion of Superheroes events, including the death of Karate Kid. He said in a statement, quote, one of the greatest strengths of the Legion is its diversity. In fact, I hold the distinction of having suggested the first non-humanoid Legionnaires in the long history of the Legion of Superheroes. Tellus and Quislet were the first non-human members of the Legion, and I'm very happy that Paul Levitz and I broke that barrier by creating them. Quote. And if you want to know when this was, he made that statement in 2002.
Wow.
Yeah, diversity mattered to him long before it was a buzzword to most of us. He continued...
No, that's good.
He continued, quote, I think that the series has always been blessed with a very diverse readership, due in large part to the message of acceptance that people understand is an integral part of the Legion, unquote. In 1987, Lytle helped Paul Kupperberg relaunch the Doom Patrol. In 2001, Lytle launched his own company, Lunatic Press. He self-published his own comic books through it and sold original art. Lytle survived by his wife Marianne and their kids. This is another case of an artist I wasn't very aware of. I was never big into the Legion in the 80s. And knowing what I know now, I'm sorry I did not get a chance to run across him at some point. He sounds like a fascinating man.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot. Last up in general comic news, a relatively popular Image Comics has been indefinitely delayed. And the odd part, Ascender. Ascender is part of a few different sci-fi series that Image has been putting out lately with overlapping stories. They appear to be from the same universe, even though they don't use the same characters. But here's what makes it odd. Ascender was close to ending. It was 2 issues before the end of the Ascender series, but then Image announced not only its indefinite delay, but they canceled all pre-orders on the final 2 issues. And this isn't a terribly long maxi series. Ascender number 15 and 16 are the issues in question.
Weird.
The series is being done by Jeff Lemire and artist Dustin Nguyen. It was a sequel to Descender. Apparently the creative team's been dealing with some kind of personal matter, which is interesting considering Jeff Lemire just announced he's working on some kind of DC, or he's about to publish some DC Black Label thing. The last new issue of Ascender to come out was on October 28th, 2020, Ascender number 14. Skip months were planned for November and December. The series is supposed to resume January 20th, but now all the pre-orders have been canceled. I have no idea what's going on.
And they've not explained it, or...?
No. As a matter of fact, the last statements by LeMire made it sound like he was finishing Ascender with a double-sized issue, and he finished scripts for the series. He said that Dustin was drawing issue number 17 right now, so there was at least two more issues to come out, in addition to 15 and 16. And 15 and 16, according to LeMire, were completely drawn, and Image Comics told Newsarama this past Wednesday evening that it was adjusting the release schedule and waiting to resolicit when confirmed upon updated dates. I don't know about that, though. If there was a delay, I'd like to think they'd have new dates picked before they suddenly delay the series.
Yeah, seems really suspicious that they're going to delay it indefinitely right toward the end.
I know. I'm a skeptic by nature. I always believe in questioning things I'm told. But there's too many odd things happening at once in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Maybe something fishy between the writer and publisher?
That would be my guess, only because, like I said, LeMire just announced he's doing something on DC the same week that Image delays Ascender. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's some kind of contract dispute I'm unaware of, which would be really odd considering Image is usually pay-for-play and all creator-owned. They generally don't own the series they publish.
Hmm. I don't know. I'm hoping that they issue some sort of statement to clarify that issue.
So do I. A little dismayed. Well, the subject of this week is an Image series, Bitterroot, Volume 1, known as Family Business. The creators of it are David Walker, Chuck Brown, and Sanford Green. Colors by Rico Renzi and Sanford Green. Letters by Clayton Cowles. Cover art is by Sanford Green. Edited by Heather Antos. And this was an interesting tale of a family of black monster hunters in 1920s Harlem, New York.
Yes, which the setting was fascinating to begin with. The premise was unusual enough. It was just so different that it piqued my interest when you were talking about it.
Yeah, and I will preface this by saying it was just one of those things I read about. I read that it had several awards. I was aware of its existence, but I never bothered to sit down and read it. Felt like a good opportunity. Mm-hmm. I will say that Sanford Green's art is very kinetic, although it's not the cleanest art I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It's fine when characters are standing. They all have this interesting personality, and his faces can be really distinct. It's kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. But when things get into motion, it almost feels like the sense of motion gets lost very quickly.
Yeah, I noticed that.
You know, and I know that sounds like a nitpick, and I'm not trying to be a butthead or, like, trying to get down on it. It's just when things are in motion or at odd angles, it seems like a couple things get lost by accident. And it did seem like
a few proportions are skewed sometimes, too. But, I mean, it's neither here nor there for me.
I also got the feeling in the second half of this, like, I don't know if Green had a few things going on, but it felt like he was being rushed, like the second half was not as clean as the first.
Yeah, I can see that.
So I'm a little curious as to what's going on. The overall story, I felt, was interesting, even though we didn't quite get a full story out of the first arc. Mm-hmm. And this did feel like something that had personality. That was undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be a little bit aware of, like, 1920s culture. I don't want to say that you had to live through it, but at least seen enough videos and read a couple stories out of it to get a real sense of what's going on. Because the characters, if it wasn't for the 1920s dress and all the steampunk technology involved, this easily could have been a group of people in, like, the 1960s, 1980s, or even, like, 2010, frankly.
Yeah, for sure. I liked that they did all have distinct, you know, not only personality, but distinct character. Distinct costumes, distinct things to set them apart.
Mm-hmm.
They were easy to distinguish from, you know, background characters, minor characters. And that's what I look for also in any comic book. You know, I want people in the foreground to stand out somehow.
Yeah. And the story started out just, I don't want to say average, but kind of typical for a lot of period pieces like this. You know, it started out setting up the kind of lifestyle of the 1920s, jazz clubs and things like that. And it was very distinct on the segregationist nature of American life in New York at this period.
Oh, yeah.
However, the first time we actually see some of the main characters fighting on a rooftop with a demon, which happens to be the rooftop of a building they own. They're called the Sangares, I think that's pronounced. And I assume that a part of their family lineage comes out of Louisiana somewhere, because I get the feeling there's Creole involved in this.
Oh, yeah. The slang and their name itself, and some of the words they use, definitely sounds Creole.
Okay. I mean, I was kind of laughing because, like a lot of these stories, it has a classical gray-haired matriarch who's trying to keep the family rolling, but on top of which, he's dealing with her granddaughter, who is... She doesn't like her roles as a 1920s woman. She doesn't want to sit there and just mix the potions for the guys to go out and fight. She wants to get frickin' involved. And that happens to be what's going on in the roof, as two men, Berg, who's trying to teach Cullen how to deal with these monsters called Jinnu, by releasing them one at a time on this rooftop for him to deal with himself, because apparently Cullen's not very good at this.
I like just his running commentary as he's the one guy is wrangling and struggling. He's like, well, you know, the reason you're handling this is because you're not so good at it. So here you go.
Yeah, but Berg is one of those people who is very intelligent. However, he has to use Scrabble winning words when simple words would do. I mean, the first dialogue bubble is Cullen, might I offer a bit of sagacious insight into your current predicament?
I love his vocabulary, though.
His vocabulary is very good, but it's also at the point where I'm just like, I can barely follow along with what you're saying, man. Come on.
Hey, don't fault a man for having a good vocabulary, even if it's a little foreign.
Now dispense with the lollygagging and pay attention to the task at hand before you do get killed, which would be most insalubrious.
You know who he reminded me of was Beast? Like, completely, like, personality-wise, like, the smart guy, he's a big guy that, you know, doesn't usually flex his muscles.
It's just the incongruity, the image of this large man with like, an eye tattooed on the side of his head, which I guess is supposed to be, like, the eye in the back of his head, sitting there drinking tea, talking to someone like he's winning Jeopardy while the poor kid is fighting for his life against this thing.
Knowing that he can just, you know, get in there, put the thing in a headlock, and it will be done with, but yeah, the kid is struggling.
Right? He's speaking as if all he's got to do is step in there, tag in, rock bottom, it's over.
And I'm feeling that because of his confidence, that would be pretty much all he'd have to do.
Yeah, but, gosh, what is the name of the young lady here? Is it Jewel?
I think so.
Sorry?
Quizzes always make my brain go blank.
Yeah. But it was kind of hilarious because she was irritated enough that she stomped her way all the way up to the roof while he's still fighting these things. And before Berg can even get involved because Cullen's being overrun, Jewel jumps in and with her bare hands starts to beat this monster until she actually borrows...
Like it's a punching bag.
Yeah, until she borrows Berg's staff to finally just finish this thing and knock it out. And even as she's telling them they have to clean up and stop making so much noise, she's walking back through the door, and there's poor Cullen just saying, I had it under control. You most assuredly did not. Yep. So, and then we get this image that they're apparently being watched by a controlled pigeon, who's being controlled by this very curious Dr. Sylvester, who mentions that both he and the woman he's taking care of were there in Tulsa in 1919, which is kind of terrifying. Because that is a very dark period in American history where one of the few very affluent, almost entirely African-American cities was destroyed by a lynch mob, pretty much. It's one of those things that's not even adequately taught in American history, not because it didn't happen or because people are necessarily trying to forget, but by the time I came around to school, it just wasn't something that was discussed.
Yeah, I don't think I heard about it until probably senior year high school, but only because my professor had a tendency to go off script as far as textbooks, which was good. Learn some of the darker times.
Oh, God, I wish I had your history teacher. My world history teacher was a Vietnam vet. Guess what I learned a lot about?
Nam.
Military maneuvers throughout history.
I mean, that would still be fascinating to me, just, you know.
Was a bit, but it was kind of a boring discussion when everyone's trying to figure out how the Germans found their way around the Maginot Line.
No, my teacher went off on probably a 20-minute rant to why the Trail of Tears was only about two paragraphs in our book when there was so much more to it, and we probably took almost a better part of a week learning about the Trail of Tears and all the atrocities to Native American peoples.
Yeah.
It's just gut-wrenching, some of the things that they don't teach you, but I loved the teachers who got in there, and we learned about the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Mm-hmm. Jeez. Well, unfortunately, getting back on track, Dr. Sylvester is a bit of an odd duck, because the pigeon he's controlling, to find out what it saw, it's not like he sat there and communed with it. He devoured it.
Raw, fresh, yeah. And wiggling.
And he and the woman he's with need the Sangaris for something, but he's being very cryptic about whatever the heck it is. Meanwhile, it turns out that the roots that they create this stuff out of, which is also where the series gets its name, may be relatively rare. So it sounds like whatever the Sangaris do to stop these monsters, they have to be very direct about it.
Mm-hmm.
As well as very succinct. So Jewel appears to give both Cullen and Berg a couple vials of what she's been working on. They inject it into the Jinnu that they still have captured on the roof, and then the Jinnu turn into people. Because it turns out the Jinnu are individuals whose minds and hearts are filled with some kind of anger or hatred, and then that somehow affects them physically, and they turn into these monstrous forms.
Mm-hmm.
Which is terribly sad, but when I said at the beginning of this episode, Bitterroot was oddly timely, considering what's been going on in the last week, I really thought you guys were going to read this and just go, he planned this.
I thought you had at first, but then I was like, no, we've talked about this a couple times. And, you know, I was kind of reading through reading between the lines. They didn't really say that there was a catalyst other than extreme angst and bitterness and
mm-hmm.
To start this, what do you want to call it? The metamorphosis,
yes.
Really. It's, you know, a personification of the green-eyed monster,
mm-hmm.
not just of jealousy, but rage.
Right.
And what human nature, no matter who you are, can make you into. And mm-hmm. just the personification of it was fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with all of that. And it was almost hilarious that Cullen and Berg are trying to take the two people who have just been cured and bring them back to Central Park, so they can just wake up and be free, when they're stopped by a couple police officers who notice two black people carrying two unconscious white people.
Yeah, and they're beat cops,
yeah.
of the era.
Right.
And if you know anything about the era, I'm like, oh no, this looks bad.
Oh,
this
yes.
This looks so bad.
But just like a lot of horror movies, before the two police can do anything about the situation, well, one of them takes a couple shots at Berg, who manages to block everything with his staff like an expert Jedi.
Like you do.
But before the cops can figure out what exactly happened here, they're both physically accosted by a gigantic vulture-like monster that looks like the Thundercat should stop at any minute.
Basically.
But it manages to hit Berg rather hard, and it's like a monster they've never seen before, so everything is just getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, away from Harlem in Mississippi is a poor black man who's getting accosted by a bunch of people in white hoods. You know, if you can't guess what that is, you're obviously not American.
Don't know a thing about American history.
Yeah, and there's this loud, freckle-faced guy who looks like Jimmy Olsen. Jimmy Olsen via Louisiana, really.
Yeah, seriously.
And he pulls off his hood, and he's angry enough to order this man hung from a tree. But before they get that far, a lot of these hoods suddenly develop holes in them from an outside source. And it turns out that one of the Sangares apparently left the family a while ago and decided to do things his own way in Mississippi.
So he went Nightwing on them?
I was going to guess Blade, but okay.
I mean, way more extreme than Nightwing, to be sure.
Yeah.
Hey, no one's complaining. He's getting results.
But in issue 2, what we learn is that this Sengar's name is Ford, and the reason why he's doing this is because since Janus become that because of the hatred in men, he's come to the decision that there is no curing Jinnu. You can't just cure hatred, so he's going to take care of it in a more permanent Punisher-style fashion. And,
which, to me, makes sense.
Yeah, and I guess in going to Mississippi, he figures he's going to go to one of the more central... one of the locations this is more likely to flourish, I guess would be the right way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And the
Sadly, true.
And the only person not taken over by their hatred to become a Genoo in this case is the poor Jimmy Olsen-looking kid, who I guess just got involved in everything but hadn't actually harmed anyone as of yet. And he was
Yeah, his white robe was been brown.
Yeah, he was scared.
Yup.
Meanwhile, back in Harlem, unfortunately the police did not survive their encounter with this vulture creature, and Cullen was badly outmatched. Berg was injured, and this creature wanted the two people that the Sangares just cured from their training session in the prior issue. Mm-hmm. And we flash back to Mississippi, and then there's Ford, who still hasn't quite decided what to do with this Jimmy Olsen-looking guy, but he has managed to lay waste to the rest of the white-hooded individuals and save the guy who's about to get lynched.
Mm-hmm.
And while this kid was knowingly mad, he was also a little bit grateful that he hadn't actually done whatever it was to make all these other people he knew turn into monsters.
Mm-hmm. And what do they call it? Like, his soul was...
his soul hadn't been tainted yet.
Tainted, and there we go.
Which, and it made the whole thing kind of interesting, because this kid was suddenly very curious about Ford. So he'd somehow very quickly gotten over his bias and just decided, okay, there's worse things to be. And it became even more confusing when this kid suddenly pointed Ford in the direction of where some of these guys may have come from originally to get this ideology.
Yeah.
You know, it's I guess it's one of those things where the story of this kid is actually more complicated than it is. He's not just a bad kid or somebody who's been historically making bad decisions. It made it feel more like he was just a guy who was looking for a mission in life, and unfortunately, you know, the wrong people picked him up first.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at least he seems to be able to change his ideology pretty quickly with convincing information,
yeah,
such as the barrel of this dude's gun. Ford has some persuasion.
Yeah, I maybe he was just looking for... It's one of those things that's more complicated than it seems. It's not a case of he suddenly decided to do right, or even that he necessarily agrees with what Ford does, but Ford is just this weird figure of strength that's shown up, and this maybe this kid's looking for someone to emulate. Maybe he's just one of those people that gravitates towards somebody that acts like they have a plan. But either way, he's just decided this is the guy he's going to follow.
Yeah. In any case, his definition of monster changed about four times in that one scene.
It was really odd.
And his face just kept contorting, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in Harlem, Berg was taken back to the Sangares building, and unfortunately, the monster that attacked him in the park seems to have infected him. He is turning into a Genoo, which is interesting to find out that that's possible, because usually it seems like these Genoo are created, again, by extreme angst or hatred in a person's heart or soul. The fact that he could be infected like this was really bizarre.
They're all like, well, this is new.
Yeah. And in issue 3, what we find out is that the two police that died in Central Park, apparently the rest of the police force, has decided to overcompensate and start raiding Harlem.
Yeah.
And they start with a dance club, unfortunately, that has nothing to do with any of the central characters in this series thus far.
Nope.
And a lot happens at once all of a sudden. Ford is taken by this kid to meet somebody who apparently had been lynching people in Mississippi for a while. And of course, it's a guy who's wearing a rebel Civil War hat and has an old-fashioned handlebar mustache. And as soon as he sees Ford, he goes insane.
Literally insane. Like, monster pops out.
Yeah, and I had to wonder for a few minutes about Sanford Green's art choices, because as this guy is transforming, it occurs to me he looked a little bit like the Pepe the Frog meme. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but I was just kind of looking at it going, are you trying to say something?
I didn't really get that. I liked how grotesque these things were. They're not just, you know, grr monsters. They're just really disgusting to look at.
Yeah. And also in the same scene is when we figure out that the kid, he isn't even like a plant or even playing Ford. As Ford is being attacked by this man-turned-monster, he hits it with a chair trying to defend Ford. You know, the kid has apparently made his decision, but what we discover is that Ford doesn't believe this is a Genoo. This isn't a monster made out of a man. This is a monster pretending to be a man. He thinks it's from someplace deeper, someplace that occasionally there's other dimensional rifts too, and this thing may have been sitting at one of those gateways.
Right, because he said, wasn't one of the things that gave it away the fact that he was not just a normal Janu is that the Janu didn't speak? They were just kind of like mindless monsters?
More or less, yes. Which made the Dr. Sylvester in Harlem even more curious, because the further the series went along, the less he seemed to be pushing against whatever otherworldly forces were in his head. And he just started to embrace it and start to consider himself a new messiah, which is, oh boy.
It's dangerous.
Yeah, never a good sign.
Anytime anyone cites that, it's always dangerous.
Yeah, never a good sign. And meanwhile, Berg is still going through transformations, and the others have had to forcibly subdue him. Not seduce, that'd be weird. And tie him to a chair. Meanwhile, Cullen says he's going to go see Uncle Enoch, which the rest of the family seems to really despise.
Yeah.
But apparently Enoch also has knowledge that the others don't, so there's a split as to what to do about that. Cullen goes anyway. And unfortunately, going back to the cops, who are still raiding Harlem, they're moving outside the dance club. And unfortunately, a few of the officers are trying to stop the others, who are getting too exuberant with the beatings they're giving the citizens they're trying to subdue. And unfortunately, some of those officers themselves are starting to turn into Janu as their hatred is taken over.
So, what is in the water in New York? It's my question.
I don't know. I guess the first question is, are these Irish policemen?
Some of them do have Irish surnames. And I was like, okay, these are very white names, like generic white men names. On purpose, I know, but like...
You know, I almost had to laugh, though, when Cullen actually made it across the river to the house of this Uncle Enoch, whoever he is. And when he steps in and you notice the ceiling is dark but full of red eyes, I had several questions. I mean, it's like when Cullen sees these things coming for him, he starts running through the house, so I start to wonder how big this place is. But at the same time, it's this bunch of... I don't know, they look like shaved mogwai. Some of them have cybernetic limbs attached to them. All of them seem angry. And I'm staring at this just going, wow, this is the worst game of Pokemon Go I've ever played.
They're kind of creepy, but kind of cute.
Yeah, it was just this real odd thing. It looks like they're about to devour him. They are all over him. And that's when this Uncle Enoch appears and pretty much explains that these things guard his house and they don't like Janu, which Cullen smells like because he had recent encounters with them. Mm-hmm. And as soon as Enoch says a word to make them stop, they all suddenly look, I don't know, almost like koala bears crossed with basset hounds, and they start crawling all over him like just pets with articulate hands.
Like chinchillas and lemurs mixed.
You know, I mean, it's like, I know Cullen's there for help, but I feel like Cullen just kind of glossed over the idea of, you have your own stuffed animal army, what the hell is going on?
I would have pressed more for, what are these, where did they come from, and how did you train them? But of course, you know, there's bigger things brewing.
Yeah, and meanwhile, back at the house, Berg is again broken free and apparently is in full rampage mode. I love that Jewel has been knocked sideways and can't get there to protect Ma Etta as Berg charges, and Ma Etta says she's too old to run and just stands there.
Yeah. And it's Berg, like, okay, yeah, she's tough.
Berg recognizes his mother and won't attack. He actually seems halfway subdued when Ma Etta suddenly whips out one of those steampunk gauntlets and punches him in the face.
Yes, that was epic.
You know, it's kind of funny because Ma keeps telling Jewel that the women in their family don't fight, yet she does this when she feels like it, and I don't know whether to yell hypocrite or awesome, you know?
I said awesome. You know, it goes to the idea that fighting and surviving are two different things. She knows how to survive. You take one look at her, she's survived a lot. You can tell.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Ford and the kid from Mississippi have finally dealt with the monster there. And Ford finds a map on the back of a painting that may have a map of the gateways, including the one this was guarding. One of them happens to be in Harlem, so Ford thinks he needs to get back home. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Sylvester is apparently absorbing the essence of several Janu forcibly to make himself stronger. And in the next issue is when things got really fast, but also kind of loose in this series, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of things that happened all at once. It seems like a lot of the people who were trying to survive the Janu attack in Harlem kept congregating at the Sengir building. Somehow they knew that the Sengir kind of deal with these things on the regular. Berg had enough of his faculties to fight on his family's behalf with Jewel, because Cullen's still trying to get Uncle Enoch, who's riding across a river on a motorcycle with a sidecar, and all these things clamoring around him while they're trying to dodge Janu cops, and, you know, it was a heck of an image.
Yeah, there's just so much happening in all these images. I kind of had to, like, zoom in and just kind of absorb the image and then process a little bit. It did seem like everything was rolling downhill pretty quickly at that point, story-wise.
Yeah, and I mean, it was all not randomness. It was all just happening so quickly. I could get into the finer descriptors of this, but there is a lot that actually happened over the next couple issues. Mm-hmm. All the way down to Ford showing back up in town at as you can imagine, at an opportune time, and shooting the lady that transforms into a vulture, not just injuring it, but eventually killing it, which drove Sengir over the edge. Or not Sengir, Sylvester.
Sylvester, yeah.
Yeah, but the thing that made it all special was that what they discovered was that there was another type of monster. I think they called it Zodos. Which are also monsters made out of men, but not made of anger. They're made of sorrow, which suddenly explains a lot of what Dr. Sylvester and his lady friend there were. Because, again, they lived through Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
Which made the whole thing even bigger, sadder, and scarier, frankly.
Yeah, tragic.
But without getting into too many details on the last issue here, simply because of a combination of time and the time needed to describe it all, because it is a lot.
A lot.
I can say that while I did enjoy Bitterroot as a read, I'm not sure it's something I would continue. There was nothing bad about it, but the visuals combined with how frantic the story became in the last couple issues of this volume were a little bit of a turnout to me.
Yeah, that's fair.
What did you think of it all?
I enjoyed the fresh story. I like new stories. I like period pieces, too. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of like, it was a period piece, and it was a fantasy, and it was like steampunk and action. So it had a lot of genres crossed over. I probably would read the rest of the series just to see how everything pans out.
I think it's still ongoing at this point.
Okay. So I'll try to track down the rest of it. I just liked the new take. It was a new story. It wasn't same old, same old. Mm-hmm. This was totally fresh take.
Yeah, that's one of the
family fighting together.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages that a lot of indie stories or creator-owned stories have over DC and Marvel, is that you don't need to know 60 to 80 years of comic books to understand what goes on in a story. All you got to do is find number ones, and often when it comes to these things, the series are usually no more than 2 or 3 years old, so it's not terribly hard to find.
Right, and they don't spend a whole lot of time setting up the premise, explaining things. They just jump right in, and you figure it out as you go along. And I like, I like the quick speed of things like that. I don't like a lot of narration. I mean, I have read Lord of the Rings, so I can read it.
Yeah, 8 pages dedicated to a rock next to a river. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. 3 chapters describing the preparations for a birthday party.
And let's not get into second breakfast.
Seriously. So when comics just kind of throw you in the middle, I'm all about that. I like the action. I like the fact that we're thrown right into their struggle on the rooftop. You kind of get a good overview of who these characters are in this moment because it is them in their element.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I really liked about this series. You know, I liked the fact that they were this family that had survived horrible things and were using kind of like old herbal remedies like Cajun remedies and science kind of together, like magic and science was kind of blended together in this one thing. I love that concept because, I mean, you can imagine the matriarch as this kind of like Yoda figure. She's the glue that keeps everything together. Mm-hmm. She's got all the old recipes. She knows what to do in situations. She's always cool, calm, and collected. But there's this resilience, like an old willow tree, where she's got deep roots and she's got strength below the surface that when push comes to shove, she'll pull out a gauntlet and, you know, knock him in the face. And I just love her character. I think she's my favorite, honestly, out of the entire group.
Yeah. The thing that really did stand out in my mind about this story, and I don't know if it was purposeful or not, was the subtextual story about, mm-hmm. at least when it comes to American society, how anger and sorrow are self-fulfilling and self-magnifying in American society.
Yeah, and self-destructing.
Mm-hmm. And it was never one of those things that came across in the dialogue, and again, I don't know if it's something that Walker and Green meant to bring across in the story, but to me it spoke very loudly.
Yeah, definitely.
So it was one of those things that I rolled over in my head, I think, a bit more than the actual story of the series.
It was thought-provoking without it being kind of drilled in your head.
Yeah. So it's an interesting read. I won't necessarily say it's for me, but I see why it won awards. It really does bring up a lot of uncomfortable issues that we need to confront more often.
For sure, for sure.
Which is one of the reasons why I like podcasting about comic books, because I always feel like they are capable of very complex stories. The only question is whether or not they're allowed to flourish.
Exactly.
So, it's definitely one of those things where you should read to get a view, I think, into the thoughts of African Americans in, you know, post-World War I America.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said early in the show, the subject of next week is going to be future state. But while Joanna is here, this actually brings up something I wanted to ask.
Okay.
So future state is a limited thing happening over the course of January and February, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But future state is also, I don't want to say line wide, but it's happening in a number of different places. So the question becomes, what parts of future state do you think we should read? I wanted to limit it to 5 issues, central story only, because all these are also oversized anthologies. So I don't think we should read every story in an issue. Just the primary stories of a few issues. And I wanted to limit it to 5.
Okay, what are the options then?
Okay, so you're going to make me bring up a list of future state. I knew I should have been better prepared than this.
Ha! Keep your eye on your toes.
So when it comes to future state, and you may need to keep a little bit of track of this.
Okay.
We have Green Lantern, Justice League, Suicide Squad, Aquaman, The Flash, Teen Titans, Shazam, Swamp Thing, Harley Quinn, Superman of Metropolis, The Next Batman, Dark Detective, which is Bruce Wayne, and Wonder Woman, in addition to Superwoman, and the original Wonder Woman, which I think is going to happen later, though.
You mean Wonder Woman,
like
Diana Floor?
No, Wonder Woman as in Diana.
Okay.
You know,
is this the one where the new Justice League has the new Wonder Woman?
Yes, the Justice League comes out as of tomorrow. I do plan on picking up an issue of that myself, just because it has the new gender-fluid Flash in it.
I would like to actually read that one particularly, because I want to see the new group dynamic.
Okay.
I'm very interested in all of the new characters. I've been kind of talking a little bit with my other comic book friends about the lineup, and it's fascinating. Ever since you shared the picture, I was like, yes, I'm about this. So that would be my vote for one.
Okay. It occurs to me that Future State is one of those rare opportunities where we have a chance to read not just about the futures of existing characters, but actually find out the status of, like, certain characters as they exist in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying
I was going to say, is Green Lantern the one from Far Sector, or a different Green Lantern?
No, it appears that the Green Lantern is going to be various stories about what happens to the Green Lantern Corps in the future. It looks like for the majority of them, their rings are either barely working or non-functional.
Okay.
The only one that appears to be in active use is actually the Green Lantern of the Justice League, which is Sojourner Muellen.
Yeah, I can never remember her name. Okay.
So I'm like you. I'm curious to read Justice League because that appears to me at least to be a snapshot of a number of characters all at the same time.
Right. More
and
for your buck.
I mean, I do recommend Wonder Woman Yara Flor only because she is arguably the biggest name to come out in this event.
Right.
But there's a question as to what to do next, because we have, like, the next Batman, Tim Fox. We have Aquaman, which is going to focus on Jackson, the previous Aqualad. It looks like as he's helping to raise Andy, who will become Aquawoman. There's The Flash. I'm not quite sure how I feel about that, because I always feel like The Flash is a transitionary series.
Yeah, I
don't mean that as a speed joke. So I'm trying to figure this out, because I want to do a bit of old and new at the same time. So how about this? How about we do the Justice League, Wonder Woman, and Harley Quinn?
Okay.
Since she is big in both the future and now.
True.
And then we can also do, say, Superman and Metropolis. I know not any of our favorite characters, but we deserve to give it a shot since it's John Kent.
Okay. And, for John's sake.
And then just because it's the one that most people will know on their own, we should probably do the central story of Dark Detective, which is what's happening to Bruce Wayne while this other Batman is running around the police state of Gotham.
He's probably having a midlife crisis and needs his blankie.
I would imagine so, but still, it's like, I think more people would be curious about what's happening to him than the story of Tim Fox as Batman.
Meh. I mean, it's subjective.
Everything can be something you enjoy.
Well, dang it, why not?
Because this isn't Burger King. Can't have it your way.
You know, they got my order wrong the last time I was there many months ago, and I don't think I'll ever forgive them.
As exampled.
I did not go speak to their manager. I ate it anyway.
No, but I think that's
not a Karen.
I think that's a good cross-section, though. We've got Wonder Woman and Superman and Metropolis, both new characters, Harley Quinn and Dark Detective, both older characters, and then Justice League hopefully helps put all this together into something we understand.
Yeah, sounds cohesive.
Okay. So we'll do future state stories, and again, central stories, not the side stories. That's a lot of reading.
Yeah, seriously.
All right, well, thank you for tuning in. I hope you and yours stay safe out there, and you know, keep an eye out. Things in America are weird. That's the best thing I could say. So have a great one. I am Jeremy.
And I'm Joanna.
The Cosmic Library is now closed.